The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, well, welcome to Suspense Radio. If that didn't get you going in the morning, we got some great authors for you to come up. I am your host, John Robb. We got Maureen Riches coming up. We got Revis Worthen coming up talking about their books. We are going to have a fabulous show. Want to remind you all, of course, that all of our shows are brought to you by Kensington Books. So please make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on their authors and their books. And also, we want to thank, of course, you all for listening however, wherever, whenever you listen to the show. You can listen to all the shows on demand, or you can listen live right here like you are right now. Of course, on Tuesday, we will be back with Beyond the Cover with Jeff Ayers and I, and we are going to have Lisa Unger on the show then, and Stephen James is going to be back on next Friday also with his story, with his show, the Story Blender. So without any further ado, I want to jump into, we are talking to Maureen Riches, and she is the author of the latest book called The Girl Who Wouldn't Die. Now, she's a UK author, and this book has already been out in the UK in her George Mackenzie series. Actually, four books have been out in the George Mackenzie series in the UK. So this is book one that is finally out now, coming out into the United States. So we're very, very pleased to be able to bring her onto the show. So, Maureen, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me, John. Yes, I'm absolutely fine, thanks. It's quite a sunny afternoon here in the UK, in Manchester, where it's usually raining.
Yeah. Also, so you're from Manchester, and normally it is kind of raining about this time of year, isn't it? It's getting close to, you're in the fall into the winter, soccer's now taking hold, And it's always a fun time.
Yeah, it is. And unsurprisingly, I write murder mysteries set in places where the weather's terrible.
With the home of Black Sabbath, you can write nothing more than, you know, murder mysteries, I guess I would say.
That's true.
So let's kind of get into it. Like I said, so right now you have four books in the George Mackenzie series, but they've come out in the UK. And now, for the first time, we're able to see The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, which is the first book in the series, available in the United States. So why don't you give everybody a little bit about what you have going on in the book, and then we'll kind of talk about the series a little bit, because I'm sure all the other books will eventually come out. And with Amazon, you can go to the UK site and buy them if people want to also. So give us the inside scoop into The Girl Who Wouldn't Die.
Well, The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, it was a huge hit in the UK as my debut crime thriller. And it's the first book involving Georgina Mackenzie, who in this first book, she is an aspiring criminologist. So she's kind of coming to the end of her studies at university. And normally she's at Cambridge University, but she's having this year in Amsterdam because here in Europe we do an exchange program where you can go and study in another European country if you're at a British university. And because she has this fantastic insight into how the criminal mind works, when a bomb goes off in the historic part of Amsterdam, Chief Inspector Van den Bergen, Paul Van den Bergen, who's a bit like Harry Hole, he's kind of a tall guy and always a bit cynical and troubled, although his trouble is health anxiety of all things. But he looks to George to help solve the mystery of who is behind this explosion. And in fact, young men are appearing murdered in gruesome circumstances. And it doesn't take George long to work out that maybe these serial murders are linked to what is suspected as a kind of suicide bombing. And so her and Paul van den Bergen, they set about trying to catch the killer, but the killer's got his eyes on her. So it's quite a gripping, fast-moving page-turner. And I did write it. I actually penned it in 2009 as my response to Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy. And George Mackenzie is my answer to Lisbeth Salander, although she's very different. And I'm hoping that you US readers will be clamouring for some of George, because she really does have that kick-ass daring do that you see more in US thrillers. So that's
Very gritty. Very gritty, I would say.
Yes. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're quite dark, but there's a little bit of dark humour running through there too to lighten the moment. Because this is really a serial killer thriller, although the series, and there's actually 5 books in the series, happily for US readers, the overarching theme is transnational trafficking. So it's not light subject matter. And you're dealing with cities that have a really seedy underbelly, you know?
Yes. I mean, the one thing that I think that I notice more from UK crime thrillers to US crime thrillers are, in the UK, things are a lot more psychological. There's a lot more mental aspect, I think, going with it. Not that, of course, they're not in the US, but I feel that there's a lot more of that psychological kind of aspect that a lot of UK writers like to do. And it's kind of the same here. I mean, it's a very insightful kind of psychological serial killer thriller kind of book kind of wrapped into one. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it crosses the line between all-out thriller, because there's a lot of action in it. And like
right.
you say, there's the psychological aspects, because George, she's going to be a criminologist. So it really is an investigation into the mind of someone who's a psychopath. She's not, but obviously the bad guy in the book is, I hasten to add. But I like to explore that kind of grey area between the good and the bad, and examine why people do the bad things that they do. So it's not just looking at someone gets murdered, we have to find who did it, it's a terrible thing, but looking into why the murderer has done such a dreadful thing, what's in their past that triggered this violence. So I think that we Brits in particular, we're obsessed with knowing what makes the criminal mind tick. And the book that started my lifelong love of crime thrillers and mysteries was actually The Silence of the Lambs. And when I read that, you know, 20-odd years ago, nearly 30 years ago, by Thomas Harris, I just absolutely fell in love with his depiction of Hannibal Lecter and the kind of warped, crazed mind of James Gunn, and what triggered his need to murder people for their skins. You know, that kind of thing for me is fascinating, and I think readers love that too.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's almost like the UK is the why, and the US is more along the lines of the how, because you kind of see a lot of that. You know, you kind of see a lot of that in the US, and I prefer more of the psychological because I'm drawn more to the Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot kind of mysteries where it's like, you know, inside the criminal mind to kind of figure out not only, you know, who did it, but why and what was the purpose of it. Because, you know, I always tell a lot of authors, even though, you know, your killer is killing people, they're not just batshit crazy. They're never batshit crazy. They always have a reason for doing what they're doing. And by trying to let the reader understand why that is, you actually will able to understand the character more. But when you're creating that kind of why and that psychological around it, were there certain aspects that you wanted to make sure that not only that, you know, George got across, but the killer got across in kind of a personality ways that when people were done finishing the book, they kind of had a better understanding of who both of them were, and especially Georgina moving forward because, you know, the series is continuing.
Yeah, sure. What I wanted to create when I was writing this and what I hope US readers will enjoy is a really complex puzzle. So you're right, it is all about why and who are these people and why do they matter to the reader. I personally don't think that you can invest in a character when you're reading a book unless they're quite complex and you understand what's going on in their life and you really root for them. Even some of the bad guys in my books, I think that the reader tends to start rooting for because people do terrible things, usually because they've had terrible pasts. So even though you hate what they've done, you sympathise with them on a certain level. But what I love about reading crime novels is being able to take several strands of a story and work out how the mystery fits together like a jigsaw puzzle. And developing the characters like that and giving them these rich backstories is a way of helping the reader to solve that puzzle. So although there's an awful lot of action going on and, you know, chases and everyone's on the edge of life-threatening situations, you've constantly got this puzzle to solve. And I hope that readers will enjoy that. It's quite satisfying for me.
And, you know, and that's very important, and you just said something that's very important, too, is I don't think a lot of fans understand. You have to be kind of satisfied yourself to kind of, instead of just going to the typewriter, banging out some words and saying, okay, fine, here's a book, you know, blah, 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 it would have no passion and no feeling. So what is the biggest thing now that you're four books into the series, even though the United States is just, again, I just want to make sure people know we're getting the first one here, the girl who wouldn't die. So why or how much passion, you know, do you have every time when you kind of get back to sit at the typewriter or the computer and start writing again that brings you back to this series? What kind of draws you in all the time?
Well, I think it's the characters. I don't think that you can sustain a long-running series without having really well-drawn characters that you believe in. I, as a writer, my characters come to life for me. So George feels real, and Paul van den Bergen, who you'll discover she has a very close involvement with, and not just on a professional level. I don't mind tipping you that wink. They are so 3D to me, and when I sit at my computer to start a new novel, I want to find out what happens to them next. So although I do plot in advance and I know what's going to happen in the course of a book when I start writing it, I leave enough space for the magic to happen. So I do find my characters surprise me. And George is such a big personality. You know, she's this smart-ass, sassy, smart-mouthed girl from a really rough housing project in the UK. And she has this very difficult family and difficult background. And yet she's studying in the kind of ivory tower of Cambridge University, and she becomes an academic and works with the police as a criminologist as the series goes on. You know, she's always the outsider. She never quite fits. And I'm a great supporter of the underdog. And it's the same with sidekick Paul van den Bergen. He always gets the kind of raw deal off his bosses because he doesn't quite toe the line politically inside the Dutch police force. So I'm constantly I'm constantly wanting them to win, but needing to put them through their paces and make life as difficult as possible. Because, you know, we have a saying over here, I'm sure writers do in the States as well, that you need to chase your characters up a tree and then throw rocks at them.
Actually, I've never heard that one before, but that is hilarious.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It sounds like something Peter James would say, that's for sure.
Yeah, probably somebody I know has heard him say that. I did meet Peter James the other year at Harrogate Crime Festival, which is a big deal here. And he's a man for some witty anecdotes.
Yeah, and then do you also go to the one in Bristol, Crime Fest? Do you go to both of those?
Yes, I do go to. Yeah, I go to Crime Fest every year. Like I say, these George McKenzie thrillers have been it's about 3 years. And like I say, the fifth one, The Girl Who Got Revenge, came out over here in April this year. But the US readers are going to be lucky if they like the series. They're going to be released within the next 6 months. You'll have all five of them. So they're coming out 1 month after the other.
Oh, that's nice.
So you won't even have to wait to find out what happens next, really.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, because you know, people today have no patience.
No, that's true, and I don't know about you, John. Sorry.
Well, yeah, I mean, people just have no patience. I mean, you know, you put out this book and people read it, and then the next question is, okay, when's the next book coming out? And it's like, Jesus, give me a chance. You know, not many people can write more than one book a year. A lot of people only do one, and some can do two, depending, but, I mean, it takes some time to get, but I just love how, you know, the impatience is like, well, where's the next one? Where's the next one? Like, you know, like you can just type it out and say, oh, I'll have it for you in a week.
I know. Well, I mean, I'm quite lucky. I do write fast and I do two books a year. So it has meant that I've got this backlist of novels that I can now put out, you know, that are being published in the States very quickly. And I think when you get into a series and you get hooked on it, and I think that The Girl Who Wouldn't Die is one of those addictive books. You want more and more, don't you? I know I do.
Yeah.
Like, I'm
yeah.
a big fan of Joe Nesbo. And when I first discovered Harry Hole, I just wanted more and more.
And it kind of took him years before people really knew him in the States. I mean, he was, of course, big over in Europe, and then people didn't really know who he was until a couple years later. So it does take some time. When you kind of come across the pond, we're happy to be able to try to bridge some of that because, you know, we'll go wherever to find an author. We don't care what country they're from. We want good stories.
Yeah.
And we want good authors is what we're looking for. But
you can tell that there's a thirst for that kind of thing amongst U.S. readers. And it's just a shame that sometimes, it takes a while for those stories to get across the Atlantic. But when they do land, like hopefully now with The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, there's a great thirst for stuff that isn't necessarily set in the US. Because I think that the themes of criminality and striving and, in my book's case, family, transnational trafficking, they all travel. They travel well.
I want to kind of get in. So when you decided that, you know what, this was going to be a series that you were going to get into and you were going to start writing, was it Georgina that got you excited about it? Was it a subject matter that you first wanted to kind of, broach and kind of research for yourself? What was it that got you in to start writing this series?
Well, the funny thing was, I went to Cambridge University and did languages there, so hence the connection with the Netherlands and Amsterdam, where a lot of the action takes place. So it divides, you know, the book kind of flits between London, England, Cambridge, and Amsterdam. So I wanted to write a thriller about a kind of really strong female protagonist that was an academic, because back in the day, I wanted to do a PhD, a doctorate in criminology. I was really very curious as to why people commit crime and what sort of people were in British prisons. So George, in many ways, when I started writing her, there was a lot of me in her because she grows up in this, you know, this kind of tough urban housing project and has a very poor family, which, you know, I grew up on a rough housing project in the UK too. So there's lots of autobiographical stuff in there. But she does the stuff that I never did. So when I was writing this first thriller with her in it, I wanted her to fulfill my dreams in many ways. So she gets to go on to be an academic and go and study in prisons and help the police track down, you know, multiple murderers and transnational traffickers and smugglers and a whole bunch of crazy guys and girls.
And, you know, secondary characters in stories I always find are, you know, really fascinating. Aside from the villains, and the secondary characters are the ones that always kind of draw me into the story, because the main character, of course, is always, you know, throughout. But I always like the contrast between the secondary characters and the villain. So which secondary character do you feel in the book, The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, was one of those surprise characters, one of those ones that you might have outlined out but really had a bigger voice than you intended them to have when you first started to write?
Well, Inspector Paul van den Bergen, he was just meant to be the guy investigating the explosion in Amsterdam. But he turned out to be something rather different, because George is having this kind of young romance with her study partner, Ad Carolfer, who's, you know, hot young guy on her course. And yet this much 20-year-old, you know, 20 years older than her, this chief inspector, comes along, and they have instant chemistry. And I realised that he was going to be a much stronger force in the book than I'd originally planned. Even though there was this huge age gap, George and Paul get along so well, and are both kind of prickly, cynical types that people struggle to get close to. And he has this outrageous health anxiety, so he's constantly fearing he's going to die, even though he's kind of this big, you know, 6'5", physically able police guy who's got years of experience under his belt. He's so traumatized by the death of his father from lung cancer that it gives him a kind of vulnerability that I wasn't expecting, and I wanted to find out more about his background. And then I discovered when I was writing him that, you know, he's a divorced man and has this relationship with his daughter, who's, you know, she's quite demanding. And this whole avenue opened up for me to concentrate on this secondary character and have different stories evolving because of how his life is. And George's backstory as well, some of the people in her life appear in subsequent novels, The Girl Who Broke the Rules and The Girl Who Walked in the Shadows, and they become central part of the story. And that is the beauty of having a series where your subsidiary characters are interesting. You make them interesting and they become real for you.
You know, and as you continued on through the series, and of course, again, we're only going to get the first one right now, but thank God, you know, hopefully in the next 5 months we'll have all of them over here in the United States. How did you kind of grow yourself as an author throughout the books? I mean, when you kind of wrote The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, and then you kind of went on to the next books in the series, how did you progress yourself as an author, not the story and so, but what will people notice from you going forward?
I think I became braver as a crime writer, because I used to write children's fiction. I was published by HarperCollins in the UK with a historical children's fiction series for 7-plus-year-olds. And when I started writing The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, it was my first foray into adult crime fiction. And she's at university, so there's still this kind of youthful element to it. And I liked that because she could do the things that, as a middle-aged woman, I couldn't. You know, I can't bend over without grunting, unfortunately, whereas George can run a couple of blocks and not break a sweat. But by the second and third books, I'd kind of embraced the very adult, gritty nature of what I was writing. So I think readers moving on to From the Girl Who Wouldn't Die to The Girl Who Broke the Rules and The Girl Who Walked in the Shadows, they'll notice that the stories become even more complex and darker, but that they're more confidently a suspense novel for adults, you know, dealing with international trafficking and some serious crime. But they're also about people's families and lives. So I think that readers will just find that the series becomes more confident and that the themes all cohere quite nicely, because I got into the stride, as you do.
Right. And was that hard for you as, you know, not as an author, but just as a person to kind of have to get into that darkness of the world that, you know, like you said, of the trafficking and those kinds of things when you're researching and finding out about this and then having to write about it? How does that affect you as just a person?
Well, some of what you research on the internet is very, very dark indeed, especially when you get to The Girl Who Walked in the Shadows. There's, you know, that kind of tackles the issue of child trafficking and paedophile rings, although it's done sensitively, I hope, and was very well received. So I've been dealing with dark topics, but I was always careful to kind of use academic articles as my source materials, so that they're a bit detached and dry, and I put my own action and imagination into them. I really didn't need to see anything more unsavoury than that, you know, because you worry about your search history, that you don't want that governmental knock on your door saying, what the hell are you researching here?
Exactly, your IP, your internet provider is going to start sending out notices.
Exactly,
like,
you got to be so careful. But well, I mean, The Girl Who Wouldn't Die has got, you know, this suspected terrorist attack. So I had to be really careful about researching because, you know, we're like you guys. We're very sensitive about researching anything about fundamentalism or suicide bombing. So that was tricky. But oddly, as I was writing these books, in my personal life, I was going through the worst of times. My mother got lung cancer for the second time, rather like Van den Berchen's dad did. And so I had to go with her as an only child through a year of going to the hospital for chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And then sadly, she did pass away in 2016. Mm-hmm. And it was a very hard time. And in the midst of that, I had a very bad head injury and was left quite ill for 4 months. And to make matters even worse, I got divorced. So it's just been agony. And it was constant drama in the worst sense of the word. So I poured all that anguish into my writing. And, you know, you can read it and see it on the page.
Well, I'll tell you, it has been fascinating to speak with you here about this series. Where's the best place for everyone to find out about more information about you? Give out all your nice social media and all your on your website,
sure,
and everything for everybody.
Well, you can find The Girl Who Wouldn't Die. That's available exclusively on Amazon. It's only 99 cents. Woohoo! Website. Sorry?
I said 99 cents. That is always good.
That's cheaper than chips, as we say over here.
Yeah.
My website is Marnie Riches, that's MarnieRiches.com. And on Twitter, you can find me at Marnie_Riches. And on Facebook, you can come and find me, Marnie Riches Author. So I am on Instagram, but rarely. That's that middle-aged technology thing. I'm slightly scared by Instagram, but
yeah.
Come and find me on Twitter, and you know, the book's being well received. People are reading it and enjoying it, so you know, it's a fabulous sleuthing duo that you won't have seen before. And Georgina McKenzie, well, let's hope that she pushes Lisbeth Salander into a corner. We'll see.
Oh, well, Marnie, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been an absolute joy to speak with you about the series, and I'm always excited when we get you know, these first glimpses into something that UK fans have been enjoying now for a little while, and now we finally get on in the party. You know, it might be a little late, but, you know, we're in the party.
I'm really excited, and I hope you guys enjoy it, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you so much, and enjoy, and we will talk with you soon.
Have a great day.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is Maureen Richards, and the book is called The Girl Who Wouldn't Die. It is the first book in her Georgina McKenzie series, even though 5 books have now been out on the UK. Luckily, we're going to get all of those in the next 5 to 6 months here over here, but make sure that this is something that you put on your radar and check out with her series and put yourself, you know, 99 cents. I mean, try it out. Get yourself involved and get yourself into that one right away. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest, Revis Wortham, to talk about gold dust. So in the meantime, listen to this. Welcome, everybody, again. After the break, we want to thank you all for staying with us here. And, of course, we are very pleased to bring our good friend to the show. We met him on his debut book quite some time ago in New York for Thriller Fest, and now 7 books into his Red River Mystery series. It is awesome. For those of you who go to Thriller Fest or go to the conferences, he's the man with the hat. When you see that hat, baby, you know it's Revis Wortham in the house. So, Revis, we want to thank you so much for coming in. How you doing?
I'm doing great, John. How are you doing today?
Hey, man, we're doing fascinating. We are doing awesome. We want to thank you so much. It's been too long to have you on the show, so it's great to be able to talk with you here again and, you know, dive back into Red River Mystery Series with Gold Dust.
Well, thanks. It has been a long time. And since you and I last talked, several books have come out. This Gold Dust is book number 7 in the Red River series, and in addition to that, I now write a thriller series called the Sunny Hook Thrillers that are contemporary stories set in Texas, and there are 2 of those, and so I'm staying pretty busy these days.
Now, Revis, I got to say, can you get closer to your phone? You're coming in a little hard of hearing just a little bit.
Well, I'm right up against it.
There you go. Now I got you.
I got it. Good. Good. I just had to shift
much
over.
Better.
I'm sitting in the truck out in the parking lot.
That'll work. Hey, you know what? Sometimes I sit in weird places to do interviews too. I was sitting in the parking lot of the Hall & Oates concert interviewing Laurel K. Hamilton. So it happens, man. You do what you got to do in this game.
Yes, you do. To make it work, you do what you have to do. That's absolutely right, John.
Exactly. All right, man. So Gold Dust. So why don't you tell us about Gold Dust, and then we'll start going back in history a little bit and hit the series.
Oh, we can do that for sure. Gold Dust came about based on a story that I read several years ago about a CIA experiment back in 1950, in which the CIA and the U.S. Navy sprayed a benign bacterial agent across the city of San Francisco to test wind currents and what the wind and this benign bacteria would do in the event of biological warfare. And it came to light in the 70s, and they finally fessed up to it after some people were killed and they were taken to court over it, and the events came out. And as usual, when I'm writing about this tiny little community in northeast Texas, Sooner Springs, I always think about what could happen if something like that would happen to rural folks back in the 1960s. And this is late 1968. In Sooner Springs, Texas, northeast Texas. And so I think what could happen if somebody sprayed an agent called gold dust over the northern part of the state to test the northern wind currents, drift an agent maybe back down toward Dallas if possible. And so with that, I started out with a crop duster in the novel, spraying a substance that had been brought to him by a couple of CIA agents to test these wind currents. But at the same time, there's a lot going on in this tiny little community. I have two protagonists that are now 14 years old, Pepper and Top. And Pepper is a precocious little girl, and she is growing up. The hormones are kicking in, and she gets crossways with a young lady that arrives in the small community and tells the lady that she has found a gold escudo, somewhere nearby. And that is based on a true story that I have heard all my life up in Lamar County, that Spaniards were attacked by Indians up near a little natural pond called Palmer Lake, and they buried their gold there. Of course, you know, you hear these myths all the time.
Yeah,
and so, so Pepper starts a gold rush at the same time, while there are two other plot lines running through this novel. It got complicated pretty quickly, and we have everything from cattle rustlers to bank robbers to people who are desecrating Indian burial sites. So gold dust got real big real fast, and I've been told by a number of people this is their favorite novel of the series since the very first one came out.
And now, do you think, now this is the seventh book, and when you kind of look back to, what was it, Rock in the Hole, or The Rock Hole, you kind of look back now until then, and you kind of see yourself as an author, do you think that you are, you know, changed in a way where, you know, not only are your books bigger, your stories, just your writing, everything just got a little bit more?
Absolutely. Oh, if a writer, and a writer has to write every day, and an author has to write every day, you get better. You become more polished, and you learn the tricks of the trade in weaving stories together. The Rock Hole was a very simple story, but it was a good one. It has been compared a number of times to Kill a Mockingbird. So it's a simple plot line, but it's very powerful. As I've gotten more experienced in writing, and I have spoken to a number of people and held workshops, I have learned to create a much larger world than I first created when I began writing. So the gold dust is more expansive. It's richer in texture, and as the storyline and the characters progress, you get more background on these folks, and you get more of their lives and the life that was going on in the 1960s. You know, we think there's a lot going on these days, but the 1960s were very turbulent with civil rights, the Vietnam War. Rock and roll was getting dark at that time, and getting darker in the late 1960s. So all of it combines to give you a much more flavorful novel of what it was like growing up back in the 60s.
Nice. Yeah, and I mean, definitely stuff got darker. I mean, we were just talking with the author from Manchester, and I was like, oh, Black Sabbath territory, here we go.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of writing a series. You get to watch these kids grow up, you know. The first novel was 1964, and they were listening to the Beatles, who had just hit town. You know, it was a great thing for them. Well, now in the late 1960s, you know, you've got Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Led Zeppelin coming in, and Jimi Hendrix. The world's changing in every way possible, and you get to watch that happen through the eyes of these two children. At the same time, you also get to watch it through the eyes of Ned Parker and Miss Becky, who are now, back then, I thought of them as old people because they're based on my grandparents, but I am of that age today. So it's not that old anymore, not when you look at it from these eyes.
Yeah. And then you decided, well, you know, this series wasn't enough, Red River Mystery. Shit, let's start another one. And so you decided to go into, you know, the Sonny Hawk series. And now, was this more, and I'm just going to jump over here because you got a couple books in there, but was that more of an outlet to explore something else as an author? Or, you know, what was the thought process behind wanting to do that?
It was an outlet to let me grow even more. I'm writing these historical mysteries in the Red River series, and I love them, and I'm invested in these for some time to come. But I've always wanted to write thrillers, and when I had the opportunity to create the Sonny Hawk series, and it's a contemporary Texas Ranger who lives out in the Big Bend area in Marfa, Texas, or Alpine. I changed the names of everything, so I created my own little town called Ballard, but it's a combination of Marfa and Alpine out in West Texas. You get to see Sonny Hawk, who deals with criminals in the old-fashioned way of the old-time Texas Rangers. You know, one riot, one ranger is all it takes, and when Sonny Hawk shows up, he takes care of business. And so this has given me the opportunity to write a different kind of story, much, much faster paced than the Red River novels. It takes off like a rocket ship, and it never slows down until the very last page. So I do have the opportunity to do two novels a year now. The new Hawk's War, the second Sonny Hawk, came out around June the 1st, and the new Red River novel, Goldust, just came out on September 4th of this month. So being able to create two different worlds is fantastic, and it's a lot of fun. But I work harder now than I've ever worked before. I retired from 35 years in public education almost 8 years ago, and I thought I worked pretty hard then. But doing this really keeps me on my toes. But it's fulfilling and it's fun, and I think my fans are really enjoying what I'm putting out.
Awesome. Oh yeah. I mean, I just thought it funny, of course, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, why not write two? So, but now you're doing this full time. I mean, this is your full time job right now, as being an author. So that gives you the ability to kind of, even though it's difficult to write two books, I don't know if a lot of people really understand that it's difficult to write two, because I think the problem that Amazon and some of the ebooks and stuff have is that you have a lot of self-published authors that all of a sudden they throw a book out every 3 months, and then people are wondering, well, why can't, like, you do it, or why can't, you know, Lee Child do it, or Karen Slaughter do it? And there's a big difference. Your books are actually edited. Their books are not. You know, and I mean, it's just, I mean, self-published authors just goes to show, I mean, 8 times out of 10, if they're not working at it, 8 times out of 10, those books are crap. And I have no problem in saying it, because they are. They don't go through the process. They don't go through the research. They don't go through the edit. They're just trying to throw words on the page and hopefully get a couple bucks a month to supplement an income, but it's not a very good read. So, you know, that's the thing that I will kind of say to you is you're kind of doing this full time to have the ability to be able to do two series at a time now, right?
Exactly. And I've always, even from the outset, when I was much, much younger, back in the early 70s, the late 70s, when I thought I could write, and I couldn't because I wasn't polished enough. I had not found my writing voice at that time. Even back then, I wanted to be traditionally published. What we had in those days was something called a vanity press, and you paid to have your books published.
Right.
But I had read enough of those books in the past that they weren't as polished as what I would like. Now, I'm not saying that my books are error-free. There's no way to create a book that's completely error-free with typos or whatever. But you're absolutely right. My books go through an extensive editing process. The continuity's there. The books are the best that I can produce. And that's what I always wanted to do is put out a quality product that people would come back to year after year as the books came out. You know, I'm producing two a year. I might be able to do three, but I am not just throwing words on the page. I am creating a world that readers will want to read in the future. They will want to buy the books read them, put them on the shelf, and then take them down at another date and read them again. That's the kind of thing that I've always striven for, and it's working now. I'm getting a great following. I'm getting recognition on there, so that people tell me to write faster, but you can only write as fast as possible. But it's leading to other things too. I was just contacted the other day. I have the honor of interviewing the bestseller author James Lee Burt in January. And you don't get that from self-publishing. You get that from paying your dues and working hard at a craft
right. That
to some people looks very simple and easy, but it does have its moments.
Yeah, definitely. You got to paying your dues is always a big thing. And, we talked music before, and I think that a lot of people in today's music don't know what that means. But, of course, we know what that means when you're looking at bands from the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s. Those guys paid their dues. They played the raunchiest clubs of 10, 12, 15 people before they were actually able to hit, arenas and whatnot. And that's the same thing in kind of writing. You go and you do your first book, and it's not going to be on the New York Times bestseller list. Very rarely does anything like that ever happen. I mean, that is a massive undertaking if it ever does. Only a handful of times. So, you might sell 1,000 copies or 2,000 copies, whatever it is, and then you start growing and then you start getting a following and then you start finally, getting yourself out there as you kind of write the books. And, how's this 7-year journey been for you?
It's been fantastic. I've always wanted to write, even from the time I was a little kid. When I was 10 years old, I was writing little short stories and sending them to Reader's Digest and little magazines, trying to get myself published, because I've always wanted to do it. So it's been a long journey. I really seriously got after it in the late 70s. Trying, nothing came about. I would send the short stories off. They would come back with a rejection notice, just thank you, but keep trying. And I did that for years. In 1988. I was sitting in a meeting, one of those boring meetings that you have to be in, but it has nothing to do with you, one of those kind of events. I was sitting in a meeting next to a young lady, and all of a sudden the people that I had been reading came to mind. I was bored out of my head, and I was reading a Donald E. Westlake novel. I don't recall which one, but Donald E. Westlake is a fantastic mystery and humor writer. And I was reading an author named Robert Rourke, who was a huge writer for magazines and novels back in the 50s and 60s, early 60s. And I was reading at the same time a book by a guy named Patrick McManus, who is one of the funniest writers you've ever read in your life. And that day in that meeting, those three guys gelled in my mind, and they created my writing voice, which I immediately sold to a local newspaper as a newspaper column, a humor column, and the Paris News in Northeast Texas in Lamar County. And from there, my newspaper columns expanded until I was writing for over 50 newspapers in the state of Texas, and I was talking to King Features Syndicate, who had called me and said, "We're going to make you the outdoor Dave Barry," which I was excited about, and that's where I wanted to be. I was wanting to get that kind of a exposure and distribution across the nation. At that exact same time, though, if you remember, a little thing called the internet came in and immediately killed off a number of newspapers. And the first thing that newspapers did when they started losing their ads is they started dropping columnists. So I lost all the way down to three papers that I still write for. I've been writing newspaper columns for 30 years. I've written almost 2,000 newspaper and magazine articles in that time. But that allowed me, like we were talking about, that allowed me to polish my craft. And I still write for those papers. I still write for Texas Fishing Game magazine. I write every day, and polishing my craft allowed me to start that first Red River novel that I began writing way back in probably 2001, and finally got it published in 2011. So it was a long road. It was a long road to hoe. But when as you said, you remember the old days in the radio when somebody came out, he was that one hit wonder maybe, or that got that one great album. They didn't come out of nowhere. Those people had paid their dues. They'd written for years. And if you come to any writers' conference and talk to the writers, that would more than love to sit down and visit with you. They will all tell you the same story. They've tried, they've worked at it, they've polished their craft until they finally found an agent and a publisher that would pick them up. And that's how I always wanted to do it. And I've been very fortunate in getting the recognition through that kind of publishing outlet, as opposed to Amazon publishing or any of the other self-publishing venues that are out there. And I tell everybody, if you really want to make it, if you really want to become an author, you have to work at it. You have to go to the conferences, but you also need to look at traditional publishing.
Yeah, in some way or form, traditional publishing is good in the aspect, like I said, of the editing. Now, if you want to be a very good self-published author and write really good books, you know, you need to go, you need to pay somebody to edit your book. I mean, I say the biggest word in being an author is editing. Either you do it or you don't, and that's the difference of either you sell or you don't. And you know, you can be self-published, but you got to invest in yourself. And, you know, this is a business. This is a business like selling, you know, like a laundromat or a convenience store or whatever it is. You have to invest in it to make it work. And, you know, Warren Buffett's always said the best investment you can ever make is invest in yourself. And I think Mark Cuban and any of the other ones will kind of say the same thing. You have to invest in yourself if you really want to, you know, be successful and go out there and do it. You just can't half-ass it. So, I mean, and the thing is, we can talk about, you know, a little bit, you know, music again. When you can change, you know, who you kind of are. I mean, you know, you didn't start out writing this kind of stuff. You kind of morphed into, you know, writing mysteries and then getting kind of, you know, into this character and finally getting comfortable with this kind of surroundings. And then you kind of jumped out into Sonny Hawk because, you know, you got more confident. I mean, I dare anybody to go back and listen to early Michael Bolton. You'd be shocked at what you might hear of what he originally used to sound like. He didn't sound like, you know, Time, Love, and Tenderness. His first three albums were heavy metal rock albums. I mean,
yes.
You know, the guitarist for Kiss was his guitar player, Bruce Kulick. I mean, you get some weird things in there. But, you know, how do you see yourself evolving later? I mean, I could see you being somebody who is writing with somebody. Has that ever crossed your path yet? Have you ever had the opportunity to be a co-writer with, you know, like a major, you know, number one New York Times bestselling author or stuff like that came up? Because, you know, you could do something with James Lee Burke. I mean, you guys are in the same realm. C.J.
Well,
Bach, something like that.
Well, thank you so much for that, for that compliment. I have not been approached by anyone to date. But, you know, that's always a possibility. In fact, I'm having lunch. I'm sitting in the parking lot of a restaurant here in Dallas having lunch with a best-selling author, a good friend of mine, Mark Cameron, who started out writing the same way I did, writing thrillers, and Mark is now the new Tom Clancy. And so, you know, he's writing for them. So that's the kind of thing that you can hope for. I'm just going to continue to be me. I'm going to continue to write my novels and polish them and become a better writer, I hope. We all make mistakes as we go along. I've made a couple of mistakes in my writing that I think a more experienced writer would have seen. For example, in the new Red River book, I've got a character that I'm bringing back. His name's Tom Bell. He's a retired Texas Ranger. And he was in my third novel, The Right Side of Wrong. And Tom was an instrumental character in that novel in helping track down a ring of car thieves and drug dealers. And in the climax of the novel, we left him shot and bleeding outside of a Mexican prison down south of the border in Chihuahua. And when I left him, I thought he was dead. But every time I go to a signing, people will come up and say, Tom Bell was my favorite character. Why did you kill him off? And finally, I realized that I had made a grave error. So I went in Goldust. I went back and brought Tom Bell back because I never said he was dead. I just said he was shot and bleeding down in Mexico. So now Tom is back, and I think he brings something new to this ensemble cast that I have in the Red River series, and he fleshes it out even more. So you learn things as you go. You know, you mentioned CJ Box just a minute ago. He's a good friend of mine. It's a glorious thing about being a writer, being in this writing world, because I've read these guys for years, and all of a sudden now I've gotten to know them, and we built friendships. Well, he and I were talking one day, and his Joe Pickett novels follow 1 year or 6 month increments, probably 1 year increments, because he wanted to watch his characters grow and his kids grow in the books. And I thought, well, that's a good idea, and I did that too. What I didn't realize is one of the great characters in my Red River books is not a person, but it is the time period itself in the 1960s of what was going on there. And so with the seven books, I've had to compact the time between books in the last two or three because I'm getting out of the 1960s, and I wish I had compacted it even more so that I could have stayed back in those turbulent years a little bit longer and explore the influences on the times and the characters themselves. So yeah, we make a few mistakes as we go along, but it's not insurmountable. It's just something that I'm going to get to deal with, and you know, pretty soon my characters are going to have to deal with disco music, I guess, and that's going to be one of the most terrifying books that you've ever read.
Nice, I can't wait for the disco, dude. You got that? I mean. That's gonna be intense.
It'll be completely different than anything I've done so far. The one I'm working on right now, the book coming after Goldust, we're titled it Laying Bones, and it's going to be early 1969. So we'll get those years in the events, both politically and with the space race and that kind of thing, and moon landings and stuff. So we'll tie those in. But as the series progresses, I'm going to have to follow it to its natural end. So we're going to get into the 70s at some point. But Goldust is solidly in late 1968. And you'll hear the music. Well, I mentioned the music that the kids are listening to at that time, and some of the events unfolding in the world outside of this little tiny community that will ultimately impact everyone. So that's the fun about writing this kind of thing, is I get to explore a lot of things. Even though I lived through that time period, I get to revisit and explore that world even further. And that's one of the exciting parts about being a writer also. And I'm sure that you know that because you talk to writers all the time, John.
Yeah. I mean, you know, every writer has their own little difference of, you know, what brings them back and what excites them, and, you know, whether it's the characters or anything like that. I think a lot of writers always feel excited about the characters because they kind of want to see what they're going to say next. Because, you know, you might sit there and you outline and you go through and you kind of have a story, but you're not really sure what they're going to say next. And I think that's the surprise for you, is kind of how your characters are going to treat you in the next book. So when book 8 comes out, sure, you kind of have an idea and you say, I want to go with this subject matter, or I want to approach this, and I want to kind of do this, but you're not still really sure how it's going to what path you're going to take to get from the beginning to the end.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I do the thing that terrifies most writers, most authors. I don't outline. I have never outlined. Well, I tried.
I love that, though.
In the outline after the second page. And there's a term that they use, and I dislike it. I'm only going to say it once. They call me a pantser, so I fly by the seat of my pants is what they say. I start out with an idea. I put my fingers on the keyboard, and I start writing, and my characters come alive on the screen in front of me. And it's as if you are writing it up there in New York, and it's coming up on my screen as if I'm reading it fresh. I have no idea what's going to happen. And frankly, I'm absolutely shocked at what people say, what they do, and how, as in Goldust here, how four plot lines tie together at the end. There's something, you know, something in the back of my mind is working on it all the time, I guess, but it's not conscious. And that just, Jeffrey Deaver, it just terrifies Jeffrey Deaver to even talk about it. He looks at me and shakes his head because he outlines extensively.
He does.
My good friend John Gilstrap. Yeah, John Gilstrap outlines quite a bit.
Yep.
Not as much as Jeffrey, but he outlines. So it to each his own. And, you know, truthfully, my first novel, I didn't even know who the bad guy was until the climactic scene when the young 10-year-old boy Top opens his eyes and recognizes who the killer is. And I threw my hands up at that point when I was typing. I said, oh, my God. And my wife, she came in. She goes, what happened? Is something, did you lose some of your work or what's wrong? I said, there's nothing wrong. I know who the killer is now. And she just looked at me. She said, well, you idiot, it's your book. Of course you knew who the killer was. And I said, no, I didn't. I had no idea.
No, I didn't know.
I thought,
you know what you
I
do the next time? You know what? You tell her, this is how Agatha Christie wrote her books. I didn't know this until recently when I read something. Do you know how she wrote her books?
No, not at all.
She would write the whole thing out, and then she would be like, she would write out the crime, the whole thing, and then she would be like, okay, now I got to figure out who did it. So she would
because
have it down, the setup, the crime, the whole thing, and it wasn't until Poirot would reveal that she would stop and then be like, now I got to figure out who did it.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
So she had no idea. So she was technically, you know what? She was the first pantser or whatever you want to say, because a lot of people call it organic writing. But you know what?
Uh-huh.
It works because, there's a million ways. Or I don't know if there's a million. Could be a million ways to make a chocolate chip cookie. As long as it's a chocolate chip cookie at the end of the day, who gives a shit how you got there? Right?
Who gives a shit
how you got there?
Yeah. Yeah, just be entertained, because we're in the
just
entertainment.
Just be a
business.
Damn good chocolate chip cookie.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of what we do. And we all love it. Yeah. Every writer is having a great time.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Shane and I were talking about artists just yesterday, and the sad fact of how our society now views art as just a throwaway thing, when it's like, do you realize what art actually is? It's not just a museum and statues and sculptures. It's books, it's movies, it's music, it's architecture, it's all these things that you might take for granted. That's all art, people. The world was founded on art, with science still being obtained, but the world was founded entertainmently on art. Art was the way that things had to come about. So for us to throw it away and just be like, oh, you know, I don't want my kid to become an author. I don't want my kid to become a musician. They ain't going to make any money at that. I tell my kids, do whatever you want that wakes you up, that gets you out of bed, do it. If you're good at it, you'll make money at it, and then you'll be extremely happy, because now you're doing what you want to do and you're living on it.
Well, and you're right. There's nothing better than doing what you love. And I have always been a huge reader. I have several books going at any one time. But I always knew I wanted to write. And, you know, it came from storytelling. You know, you were talking about people in the dim mists of the past. They would sit around and tell stories either to remember their history or their people. Yeah, or they started to make stories up for entertainment. And so what we're doing here, we're not doing it around the campfire. What we're doing is creating something you can hold in your hand, you can read. It's much more involved. It's much richer than a spoken story in many ways. And then you can put it on a shelf and come back and read it again later if you want to. That's one thing I always wanted, to have books on a shelf that would outlive me, that would be here 20 years, 30 years down the road. And I have two daughters that are both in education, and they understand that. They see those books with my name on the shelf. And even though I'm going to be gone one of these days, and I'm going to have a little hyphen between my birth date and my death date on the tombstone, I wanted more than the hyphen. I wanted something else to leave behind too. And so I'm leaving behind kids and grandkids. I have a brand new grandbaby that showed up a couple of days ago. So they
nice.
We've got him now, so that makes number seven. But then they can come back. He won't be able to remember a whole lot about me as he gets older, but he can come back someday in 10, 15, 20 years and pick up those books and read between the lines, and he'll know who I am and what I am at the same time, because an author puts themselves in the novel. They may not be based on the author, The author creates characters, and I've had people get upset with me about some of the people that I've created, but I keep telling them it's fiction. It's not me. It's fiction because we're in the entertainment business, and so I am putting it out there for everybody to enjoy. But you know, if you think what you read is absolutely 100% me, then you're going to be completely wrong, especially some of my bad guys.
Exactly.
I'm not that bad.
Well, I'll tell you what, Revis. It's been an absolute pleasure to sit here and speak with you. Love talking with you. We're going to see you next year in Thriller Fest in New York, which will be really great to go back and catch up with everybody. So give everybody real quick the your website, social media, all the best place to find out more about you.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity. You can find me. We do a lot on Facebook, so you can see something new on my Facebook page every day. And it's Revis, R-E-A-V, V as in victory, I-S, Wortham, W-O-R-T-H-A-M, or Revis Z Wortham. I have two pages. One is a personal, one is an author page. If you'd like more detail on the books or more detail about me or where I'm going to be in the future, go to my website at www.revisz.com. That's Z as in zebra, RevisZWortham.com. Or you can just get there with RevisWortham.com. They'll both take you to it. And those are the two best ways. I'm on Twitter at RevisZWortham. So I'm on all these. We talk about old-timey words and old-timey things that come from our past, but at the same time we're talking and music and just about anything. The only thing we don't touch on is religion, politics, or sex. But if anything else interests you, then come on over and join us because we're having a great time. In fact, I posted some new stuff just today on my Facebook page. John, it's always a pleasure to see you, talk to you,
nice,
and Shannon.
Yep.
And Mark,
we said hi and congratulations on getting the gig. Did he take over for Graham Brown or Mark Greeny?
I don't know if he's taken over. I think he's just part of the team now.
Okay, so he's just part of it because I know Clancy has different storylines going. I didn't know which one he was involved in because, you know, Mark Greeny is writing, you know, he writes some, and then Graham Brown was writing some others. And so I know I saw Mark's name on one that I hadn't had a chance to read yet. But, yeah, ask him what his word count is. I think it's probably 140,000 he's probably going to go. I think that's what Mark Greeny says that he has to do when he writes a Clancy book.
Wow. I know. And, you know, I get up to 114,000. I start getting nervous because I know I'm going to have to
Yeah,
cut
and then your editor
out.
Says, knock it back to 90, Revis.
And that's happened many times. I had to check out.
Yeah, man. All right, dude. You have a good one. Go get some lunch and tell Mark we said hi. Thanks so much.
Later, brother. All right.
Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is Revis Wortham, and the book is called Gold Dust, seventh book in the Red River Mystery Series. Go out and grab that right now. So we want to thank you all for joining us. We've had a fabulous show. Maren Richards was on here, The Girl Who Wouldn't Die, Revis Wortham and Gold Dust. Go check out both of those books. And subscribe to us on iTunes and listen to us wherever you are, in the car or walking around, whatever you got to do. We'd love to hear from you, too. You can email us at radio@suspensemagazine.com if you want to know any more information or ask one of the guests a question, and I'll shoot on over to them and get you an answer. So pretty easy stuff. So until next time, everybody, thank you so much. Keep reading. See you next time.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.